Hi, this is Tamson Granger.
This is Dan Abuhoff.
With Tamson and Dan Read the Paper. It's actually Monday, August 28th.
And it's a special birthday edition of Tamson and Dan.
Whose birthday?
It's Sadie Eleanor Abuhoff, our daughter. A shout out to Sadie Eleanor Abuhoff, with whom we spent the weekend in lovely Arlington, Virginia, right on the border of Washington, D.C. And we got into D.C. more than a little bit.
Right. One of the highlights was going to a Mets-Nationals game.
Some might call it the highlight. We were at the Mets-National game on Sunday.
Beautiful day.
Lovely, yes, National Stadium. It was a beautiful day. The Mets won, and that, as if that was not distinctive enough, it was on a special weekend for Major League Baseball, a day in which they replaced the names on the uniforms with nicknames. In other words, what they did was, instead of having a name like Wilmer Flores, a player for the Mets, stitched in on the back of his uniform, they had him choose his nickname and put it there, and in his case it said Catire, C-A-T-I-R-E. Now, this is an interesting strategy, and maybe has some merit to it, if you have a team of established stars and people know who they are. That is not the Mets' situation. The Mets have a team of minor leaguers who are trying to make it into the major leagues, by and large. And as a result, I think Ms. Granger will agree that...
It was the stupidest idea ever. Ever.
Because
I only have a passing knowledge of who the players are.
Right.
And now they don't even have their names.
Right.
They're being referred to by their actual names by the announcers, but the scoreboard says something else.
Right.
Their uniforms say something else. And it was totally confusing. I caught on to a couple of the names.
Right. Okay, all right.
El Nino. But
the biggest star in the
general...
Team, yeah. Well, look,
it did not enhance the experience. I know the idea. They want to sell
uniforms.
They want to sell the jerseys in the gift shop to people. Now they have to have the one with the nickname in addition to having the jersey.
And they're very open about it. They say, isn't this a great idea for marketing? So it's tough enough to know who Eric Goodell is.
I found it
even tougher to know who Goopy is.
Confusing.
Paul C. Walden Pauly.
Not my favorite.
Yeah. So that was lost on us.
Thank goodness it was a beautiful day. The hot dogs were tasty.
And the Mets won.
Yeah.
I think the Mets won.
And you would say, I think, that it was a good game.
It was a good game. It was the Mets won against all odds.
Were I into baseball at all, I would have been on the edge of my seat. I just knew it.
Okay, yeah, that's probably true. So being in Washington gave us a chance to look at the local newspaper, the Washington
Post. Yeah, we like
to
look at the local paper, the local weekend papers when we're traveling.
Right.
And, the Washington Post had a few things of note. I mean, it is interesting that these papers at all, and the Washington Post is a pretty big paper.
It is.
But it does have some kind of local, regional stories as well.
Yeah.
So that's fun, and it gives you a little something to look at. It was a little nostalgic for me because in their real estate section, the article was about living in Kensington, Maryland, which is where I grew up.
Right.
And it said it's a very nice neighborhoody place to live. People are very friendly, and the prices are lower than comparable houses in Chevy Chase or Silver Spring. And it's only... and there is a choice of several metro stops fairly nearby. They didn't mention, however, the Mormon Temple being in Kensington, which seems like a rather big thing. And you kind of wonder what kind of impact that makes. But anyway, so that was nice. A little shout out to Kensington. And then there was also a kind of an article that I found amusing. It's not like I'm some music maven, but... there's a the headline on the arts and leisure section is Despacito went viral, but can it be vital? The test for the summer's catchiest song is if its success can lift more Latin pop music into the mainstream.
Right, and our reaction.
This is a super, super hit.
Right.
The greatest hit of all time.
And yet you say to
yourself. In terms of the music and the video.
Huh.
And yet We still don't consider Latin music in the mainstream.
I do. I do. But they have a way of thinking about it, right?
So for one thing, this is in Spanish, and right. a lot of Latin music right. we think of that's in the mainstream
right.
is actually, you know, Ricky Martin, Iglesias, and Jennifer Lopez, and people singing
in
Latin music in
English. And Despacito was in Spanish.
So there's that.
Yeah.
They also say that maybe they're just beginning to understand how much people are into Latin music, because you now have ways of recording, collecting data on how many people are streaming mm-hmm. These videos and the music, etc. So, but I
got to
say,
or maybe the Washington Post a little behind.
I thought Latin
the time,
music was already here.
Yeah, I think so
too. Joe Beam about it.
Honestly, maybe it's a clearer presence in New York than it is in Washington D.C.
I find that hard to believe, but
you grew up in Kensington.
There is a whole country out there.
You're from Kensington, Maryland, not me. So what really threw me?
Yes, the south side of Kensington, Maryland.
Exactly. Well, when we got together in college, you told me you were a Southern girl, and to me, Maryland seemed to fit the bill. So there you go. You have to live up to that reputation. So what struck me in the Times floored me. Maybe it shouldn't, but. There's an article called No Joystick Required, and it's about being able to control technology with thoughts. And here's how they explain it. They say, you pull a headset over your eyes, a game begins, your task is to break out of a room that you are seeing that has white walls, but you cannot use your hands, and there's no joystick. You have to use your own thoughts. You turn toward a ball on the floor, and your brain sends a command to pick it up. With another thought, you send the ball crashing into a mirror, breaking the glass and revealing a number scribbled on a wall. You mentally type that number into a large keypad by the door, and you are out. True? False? Fantasy? The answer is, it's not fantasy. It's a little limited. You have to look at the ball when you think about it, but it works. You can actually control the game, in this case, with your mind. The headset picks up your brain waves, and they use algorithms to decipher an individual's brain waves based on a certain level of experience. Now, of course, they're thinking of other uses, not merely more complex games, but also things like typing into your phone just by thinking words, and they type into your phone. They say they're starting to advance on that, although right now it would require that they plant a chip in your brain, and there's a little bit of resistance to that from the consumer angle. But
my computer doesn't want to know what I'm thinking about it a lot of the time.
It's the idea you can control anything with your brain waves, to me, is startling. So there you go. The other thing that's startling is that New York State completed a project. They completed the Tappan Zee Bridge.
Almost. They've opened part of it.
They've opened part of it, but it's going to be completed, and it's against all odds. It's the biggest bridge project in this area since 1964, which is when they built the Verrazano Narrows Bridge. And, of course, technology has improved. In this case, the method of construction has improved because they finally figured out that you should let the same people design and build the bridge. And they bid it out that way. Resulted in enormous savings, supposedly. Yes, it cost $4 billion, but it could have cost $5 billion.
And it came in on budget, right?
Came in under budget.
Under budget. Very nice.
And on schedule. And
they used a big, big crane.
They used a crane. Apparently, the crane, it's called the Left Coast Lifter. It has a name. It's a crane with a name. It was in the West Coast. And they brought it east. It would have been used in a project in the Golden Gate. And that crane
makes
all the
difference.
Yes, I
understood it paid quite a toll to get through the Panama Canal.
Was it more than $11?
I heard it was $70,000, but even that sounds reasonable, doesn't it?
I think
compared to $15 every time you go over the Verrazano.
Well, the key is, if you have an easy pass, you don't see the $70,000 until the end of the month, and I think it goes down much more easily. So we're all impressed with that.
Because we love bridges. We love new bridges.
People talk about infrastructure. You very rarely see it. And listen, you got to give credit where it's due.
All right, so we got these bridges going. Let's just get the tunnel. The new tunnel.
Forget that.
We need that.
We're not going to see that. In any event, there was an interesting article in the Times about community colleges. I know that caught your attention.
Yeah. Gail Mello, who is the president of LaGuardia Community College, wrote an op-ed piece in the Times struck home with me, being an adjunct instructor at several community colleges. And she set out some facts that I think were surprising to see in print.
It was surprising to me. Did you know these facts?
No, I didn't. I have a feeling for some of the ideas they represent, the realities that they reflect. But she says here that of the country's nearly 18 million undergraduates, more than 40% go to community college. And of those, only 62% can afford to go to college full time. That's because a great percentage of them are 40% of those students work at least 30 hours a week. And, because of this, it is not uncommon for these community college students to take anywhere from 3 to 6 years to get these associate degrees to move on. Right. And there are, all kinds of conflicts involved.
Right. They also say that a number of these folks are in households where the income is under $25,000 a year.
Well, specifically in LaGuardia Community College, 77% of the students, 77% of the students are in households with less than 25%.
I mean, that's quite a contrast from what everyone's general image is of what college life is like.
Right.
And it wouldn't be worth mentioning if it was only 5 or 6% of the folks going to college, but it's almost half of them.
And a surprising amount are older, not super old, but at least a quarter over 25, and about 25% are single parents.
Right.
So we have a variety of factors at work here. You also have a great many immigrants and first generation immigrants.
Well, it says that in the article, but frankly, I've heard you describe just these students over the last several years. These are the students that you have in your class.
Absolutely. I have in one school in particular, I have a shockingly diverse student body, and which is really fun when you're teaching Renaissance art, because, I mean, I may have to explain, Christian theology to Hindu practicing students or Muslim, et cetera, even the Protestants aren't as familiar with all of that.
What really strikes me listening to you describe your experience is number one, the challenges that a lot of these kids face, not just in terms of English being the language they speak, but they didn't grow up with that language. It sort of limits their writing skills. You've spoken about that previously. But a lot of challenges they face economically, and kids miss class for all kinds of reasons in terms of watching their children, watching their parents, having a court date, having a relative with a court date.
Also transportation.
Right.
Many of the students depend on buses, et cetera. Mm-hmm. And so for you to say, go to the Princeton Museum for this assignment or go to the Metropolitan Museum for this assignment, they have to do some real juggling even to manage
the payoff is when they do go to the Metropolitan Museum.
It's a revelation.
Well, it is a revelation as you describe, but more than that, as you've told me many times, they bring their whole families.
Yeah.
So you're telling a student, we're having an assignment, we're going to go through the museum, we want you to describe one piece of art for a paper, and they show up with parents in tow. Extended family in tow. Mm-hmm. And it seems that it's a revelation not only for them, but for their entire family.
So part of the point of this article is that community colleges need more money. In some ways, they're quite restricted by the state constraints about funding. There's also the problem that because these students' lives are affected by so many more things like just having transportation and food and housing, that there are these financial needs that aren't being addressed. She also brings up that in terms of charity, last year more than $41 billion was given in charity to higher education, but a quarter of that went to just 20 institutions.
No, I knew that's what you were going to say.
Okay. Yeah, right. So community colleges with almost half the undergraduates receive a tiny fraction.
Right. Yeah.
Okay, so it sounds like this is a place where we really need more funding.
Yeah.
And it would be well
advised. No, I'm with it. I'm with it. So what took place this week was the much ballyhooed fight between Conor McGregor and Floyd Mayweather.
Ballyhooed is right.
Ballyhooed is right. So Conor McGregor...
Did you know that McGregor has a stylist?
No.
I mean, Mayweather may have one too, but I ran into an article somewhere about his stylist.
All right. Well, let me just get this out because I'm not going to get it right. McGregor, mixed martial arts, that's his thing, and he's a champion in that area. Mayweather being a more conventional boxer in the way we think of boxing. And it was an odd mismatch because they had to choose one set of rules. They chose boxing, which meant basically that McGregor couldn't use his feet. No
kicking
allowed. And
his feet is a big thing?
In the mixed martial arts, it is a big thing.
Okay. But Mayweather's elderly, right?
Mayweather is older. He's past his prime, but he's a very good fighter. But anyone who sort of looked hard at it found it hard to believe that McGregor could make much of a fight out of it.
Mm-hmm.
He didn't make much of a fight out of it, according to this report. According to the Times, they describe it as the, quote, fleece of the century. They say that basically it was a mismatch from the word go, that there's no way McGregor could have done much with Mayweather, but that wasn't the whole point. The whole point was, in fact, and this is not really going too far afield from what we all thought about this, money, right? So what you had was, and you're not going to be shocked at these figures, Tamsin, even as sophisticated a girl as you, is that McGregor earned for the fight $100 million. That's not the gross.
McGregor?
McGregor, earned that. That's right. Mayweather earned $200 million. $200 million. Okay? Again, not the gross. This is the payment to the individual fighters. And as the Times describes it, it was just a show. Just a sham. But that's what boxing is, I guess, at the end of the day anyway. You can't really expect much more than that. As the Times puts it, when it was over, the two pugilists who supposedly were barking at each other or really hating each other before the fight to promote the fight, they hugged at the end of the fight. They laughed. A pair of business partners who had just pulled off the score of the century.
Yeah, why not?
Well, look, I had to wonder who was interested in that. It wasn't me, but obviously a lot of people were. And it certainly causes you to reflect for the moment how many boxing fans or MMA fans there are. And again, going back to the Washington Post, this is where I learned this. Just a stat. They said 25% of people identify themselves as fans of mixed martial arts. Surprising
really?
Number. 28% identify themselves as boxing fans, a little higher than that. And as to people who identified as one or the other, according to the larger number, 38%. 38% of people. I can't say 38% of the people I run into identify themselves as a fan of one or the other.
That sounds highly improbable.
Maybe it's a demographic thing. I don't know what it is. But listen, the money's there. Money talks. So okay. There you have it. The museum report.
Museum update.
Oh, the update.
Ding,
yes.
Ding, 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 ding.
Yes, thank you.
I just want to, there's a couple of fun things around town, around New York, that I just wanted to mention to our listeners.
Sure.
Because they're closing soon. So I just wanted to encourage people to go to a couple of different places. One would be the New York Historical Society, which is on Central Park West in the high 70s. Mm-hmm. And on the fourth floor, they have an exhibition, I think it's probably a revolving exhibition, of Tiffany lamps.
Okay.
100 Tiffany lamps.
All right.
And, you know, Tiffany lamps, I mean, we all got kind of tired of them in the, I think, the 70s
I can't get
and
enough.
80s.
Yeah. All right.
Every seemed like Fern Bar and Burger Joint had Tiffany-style lamps.
Not real Tiffany lamps.
But the New York Historical Society has an outstanding collection. Okay. And so they really, the real lamps are just fabulous to see lit up. That's on the fourth floor. There's also, if you're a fan of Eloise, you know, the Kay Thompson's
yeah.
book, Eloise, there's an exhibition on her with the, you know, artwork from the books, et cetera, mm-hmm. some vintage dolls.
Right.
So that might be fun. Kids under four are always free there, and it's open late on Fridays. And later on Fridays, you can pay what you want. So you have that at the Museum of the City of New York. There's an exhibition of World War I posters. Now, World War I posters can be pretty fantastic. And that's because there was kind of a committee of illustrators, popular illustrators, successful right. illustrators from the time. People like James Montgomery Flagg, Charles Dana Gibson, you know, the Gibson girls, Howard Chandler Christie, Edward Penfield, and they donated their services to design posters, you know, for the Red Cross, you know, recruitment posters, etc., for the cause. And they really are visually stunning. Mm-hmm. So I would encourage anybody to go and see some of those. Bucks County Community College, actually, where I teach, has a fantastic collection mm-hmm. that was just kind of left behind mm-hmm. by the Tylers in the attic. And so that Museum of the City of New York, pretty far north, 103rd Street. And Fifth Avenue.
Right.
But it's open every day, and everybody under 19 is free. And I think it's one of those places where they only have a suggested admission.
So for you, it's always free.
The Jewish Museum.
Right.
The Jewish Museum, 92nd and 5th,
yeah.
has an interesting exhibition of the work of Florine Stettheimer. Florine Stettheimer was a poet, designer, painter, an icon of the jazz age. I was actually introduced to her by one of my student papers, a research paper, mm-hmm. you know, where they have to go to a museum and they find a painting they like. And somebody did one by Florine Stettheimer that's in the Philadelphia Museum. And it's kind of fun stuff.
Yeah.
There's a great picture on the museum website of her looking very 20s right. with the bangs and the kind of flapper dress, etc. So she's an interesting person. She came from a wealthy Jewish family in Rochester, and she and her mother and sisters had a salon. You know how they had salons
yeah.
in France, like, and people come over, like, you know, the intelligentsia and the artistic community.
Like Sarah Bernhardt, that type of thing, right?
Well, Sarah Bernhardt, are you thinking of perhaps Gertrude Stein?
Yes,
is who Stein. You're thinking of.
Gertrude Stein yeah. and Alice B. Toklas.
Right, exactly. Right. So she, you know, had that kind of thing going in New York.
Right.
Anyway, the Jewish Museum, great museum, mm-hmm. fun museum. It's open, it's free on Saturdays.
Mm-hmm.
And again, very, I think children under 18 are free. And it is a great gift shop, to be honest. Lots of, if you like Judaica, especially. And at the Met. Okay, here's something at the Met, which yeah. is not going to excite you at all.
Okay.
18th century pastel portraits.
You're right.
Okay, and you're thinking 18th century, you're thinking they're, you know, kind of foofy sort of right. Portraits. You know what pastels are, right?
Yes.
There's chalk.
Yeah.
It's a type of chalk. Well, I agree. They may not seem enticing, but here's the thing.
Yeah.
Pastels, portraits in pastels are unbelievable.
Mm-hmm.
They are really compelling.
Mm-hmm.
All right. Now, pastels get a bad rap because it's not very durable. It's very fragile.
That's what I was thinking. Okay? How long can it last?
Okay. But here's the thing.
Yeah.
Because of the way pastel works, it, you know what it's similar to? It's similar to how a woman wears powder.
Yeah.
You know, women powder their faces.
Right.
Okay. It's not just to blot away the oils, actually. Right. The powder is these little discrete bits,
yeah.
right? Each little bit
right.
reflects the light slightly differently.
Right.
So when you powder your face,
yeah.
you get kind of a glow.
Right.
Same thing in the pastel portraits. Pastel portraits, because of all those little discrete angles of light reflecting and refracting,
all right.
the portraits seem to glow and seem all the more alive.
Okay.
So you know, get a chance, pop into the Met and check out those pastel portraits that are just going to be there for about until October. So that would be fun. And of course, at MoMA, the Museum of Modern Art, got to see the Frank Lloyd Wright celebrating his, 150th birthday, all kinds of 450 works, drawings, models, furniture, and the Rauschenberg that I mentioned before.
Right.
And so, and the Rauschenberg, I think, would actually be a fun place for kids. It's just big, kind of lively stuff.
Right.
So there you have the museum update.
All right. The New York Times has replaced their lead book critic.
I know, much to your distress.
Well, I mean...
I know you're a fan.
Okay, so let me try to get it right. Michiko Kakutani, who goes by Michi, has been the lead book critic at the Times for a long time. She started the newspaper 38 years ago, and she's a fixture at the newspaper, and it was recently announced that she's leaving. There's an article, not in the Times, perhaps not surprisingly, Vulture.com, which is related to New York Magazine, in which she is described as inimitable and irreplaceable, which I think is fair. She is a fabulous writer. She's been writing fabulous reviews for a long time. To me, a book review is quite important because you make a big investment when you read a book. It's an investment of your time. It's not just an investment of money. I don't want to start down that road unless I know a little bit about the book, and a fair bit. And she's just terribly insightful. She writes in a very compelling fashion. It's informative. It gives you something to think about when you're reading the book. And she's extremely prolific. I mean, she could knock out these reviews like nobody's business. As this article says, she was super intense. She could write a cover story in 2 hours. She came up in the New York Times with a bunch of other very well-known writers, with Walter Isaacson, with Frank Rich, with Maureen Dowd, with Graydon Carter, who's Vanity Fair now, and the Joel Abramson, the former executive editor of the Times, and this is a quote, considers her hands down the best critic at the New York Times. An intellectual who can synthesize many strands of both culture and politics in a way that we haven't seen. I think that's fair.
So what's the deal? I mean, 38 years. Is it just time for her to retire?
Or? You know something? The answer to that might just kind of be yes. I mean, for those of us who have been working at the same job for a long time, you can't help but see something about this experience in your own life. I mean, no one really questions her ability as a critic, even now. But over 38 years, a work culture changes. The Times culture has changed.
Well, I thought their organization, their organizational structure.
That's what I'm referring to as the culture, but it's fair enough. So they've
gone. It's actually altered.
It altered, but it's more of a group thing. It's more of an online presence. It's shorter pieces. It's more chatty. I'll give you an example. Michi never puts the word I in her review. She never says, I kind of like this, but I'm kind of a soft spot for X, which you see in all kinds of reviews, including other Times book reviews. That's mm-hmm. not the way mm-hmm. she writes. Mm-hmm. Very precise. I think she's right. I think that's kind of a crutch mm-hmm. To use that kind of thing. But it's not folksy. She's not speaking in vernacular. She's speaking mm-hmm. from a little bit of an intellectual distance. Maybe that puts her out of step. I don't know. And yet, at the end of the day, it's funny. You wonder if anyone at the Times would argue whether she's still not among the best, if not the very best writer at the Times, certainly in the op-ed critic section. And yet, there isn't quite the place for her. They say she was given a little bit of shove on the way out. Mm. So,
and you were telling me something about Wall Street Journal and New York Times.
Oh, well, that's a long story. They're back and forth. But they're at each other's throats for something. That's the Times wrote an article about inside doings of the journal, some exchange of emails in which the editor of the journal was criticizing some of the writers for editorializing when they should be writing news, in particular about Trump. And the Times, in sort of a catty way, ended the article with a reference to the fact that that particular editor of the journal plays golf with Trump every once in a while. They kind of left it at that.
Okay.
And the
not that the Times ever
But the journal responded because the Times is in a libel suit with Sarah Palin, and the journal wrote an article the very next day saying that maybe the Times deserves to lose this libel suit against Sarah Palin. And frankly, you know, news organizations always line up together on libel suits. So it's gotten pretty fierce between them.
Hmm. Well, speaking of books, you know, I maligned that book, What She Ate.
You did.
By Laura Shapiro. Although the one good thing I got out of it was brought back to mind the author Barbara Pym. Mm-hmm. And and apparently I'm not the only one.
Right.
I've seen a bunch of articles recently about Barbara Pym, including one in the New York Times entitled A Most Gentle Comedian of Manners. And it really brings to mind the kind of writing she did during the 50s and 60s. She was a shrewd observer of people, fatuous romantic idols, doddering priests, love-struck bedsitters, and a certain kind of middle-class woman, no longer young, not quite beautiful, whom society finds it easy to overlook. These are, again, gentle comedies about women who find themselves nearly invisible to men, which gives them a sort of second sight into men's shortcomings and a clarity that their more tempestuous counterparts lack, coupled with a charity their targets scarcely deserve.
I thought all women were attuned to men's shortcomings.
Well, some are apparently too busy, and Pym. This article by Matthew Schneier. Pym is formidable, but she is also kind. She may be prim, but she is not stiff. Her characters may be unworldly, even while proclaiming their worldliness, like the imperious elderly Miss Doggett in Jane and Prudence, who knows that men only want one thing, but can't remember what it is. Those books.
I'm surprised that would resonate with you.
The one he most highly recommends is Excellent Women, but there's a bunch of them. And
some men can remember what it is.
They're a gentle read. I don't think Michiko would go for them. Seem a bit gentle for her, but...
Maybe.
I
think she'd give it a fair shake. The Michi article is funny because they said some people criticized her and said that first she would like an author, then she wouldn't like an author. And they talked about Richard Ford. Well, I got news for you. Richard Ford's early books were really good. The later books weren't so good. So it's not Michi's fault. Then the Times had an article that I'll just briefly refer to. It was this, in the review section that's headlined, Networking is Overrated. And this may seem obvious to a lot of folks, but maybe not to everybody. It turns out the Times says, or at least Adam Grant, who's a professor at Wharton, says, based on studies, it's not really who you know. It's what you do. Who knew?
Late breaking news.
Yeah, it says that this Wharton professor says that his students often believe that if they simply meet more important people, their work will improve. He says, but that's not true for two reasons. First, number one, people find self-promotion distasteful. Believe it. Believe it or not. And second, it's remarkably hard to engage with people who you want to be your sponsors, let's say, unless you've already put something valuable out into the world. That's what piques the curiosity of advisors and sponsors. So it's, you know, to have a bunch of phone numbers, to send a bunch of emails, to shake a bunch of hands, to slap a bunch of backs, doesn't really get you far. It doesn't resonate unless you've done something.
But by the same token, you can't... I have been in situations where you're doing good work, working hard, and, you know... If no one knows about it.
You're absolutely right. And he says this. You need both. You need both. And yet there's a whole culture that seems to think you only need one, and it's the networking. I'm telling you, there are people who believe that. We're making a living on it.
It seems like more fun.
Okay. So, and finally, we'll close with this. It's an interesting thing going on in the New York Times. This is similar to the effort that you had a few years ago to get everyone in a particular city to read a particular book. And I remember Chicago did this, and... They came up with the, what's the great book? Atticus Finch,
To Kill a Mockingbird.
To Kill a Mockingbird. There you go. So everybody in Chicago was alerted to the fact that you'll read To Kill a Mockingbird and they can discuss it on the subways or whatever.
So now we only have to...
go to a movie. Because they of course...
Now, who put them up to this? Like AMC?
Movie association. So the question was that they felt that they wanted to get New Yorkers to choose the, quote, quintessential New York film. And the way they decided to go about that was they would go to the critics at the Times, in particular Manolo Dorgas and A.J. Scott, to ask them to identify five finalists for quintessential New York film for which people would vote. So without dwelling on this, let me just say that A.J. Scott and Manolo Dorgas are in a different category from Michi.
Isn't it A.O. Scott?
A.O. Scott, I'm sorry, when it comes to criticism. So let me tell you the list they came up with. They came up with the five finalists for the quintessential New York film are Crooklyn, On the Town, but I should explain. Crooklyn's a Spike Lee movie, which was kind of a middling movie. On the Town, which I think most people know, 1949 musical. About sailors coming into port in New York. New York, New York, which is a movie that you and I saw when it first came out with right. Robert De Niro and Liza Minnelli, which was never thought to be a great film, but has a memorable song. Desperately Seeking Susan, which is Madonna's debut, but a film that perhaps is not that widely known even now. And The Wedding Banquet, which is by Ang Lee, which probably is the most critically praised film in the group, and yet I question its candidacy because it is not in English. It's a film that's in Chinese, and you would like to think that if someone asked you to come up with five nominees for the quintessential New York film, you could name five English-speaking films, but apparently Scott and Dorgas weren't thinking that
constrained
way.
Constrained by that.
No. So it's fun to think about what the five finalists might have been, and...
what'd you come up with?
I came up with about 30 films that I thought were better candidates than those. I won't bore you with that. Interestingly, we discussed it with Sadie, her being her birthday, and she, in about 8 seconds, came up with When Harry Met Sally, which she felt was uniquely qualified because there is a plaque in Cat's Deli where a critical scene in When Harry Met Sally takes place. You may remember that scene. Mm-hmm. And was a woman, should we go into that?
No, don't.
That's not.
Everybody knows that scene.
Everybody knows that scene.
Move along.
Okay. Sex in the City.
The movie.
That's correct. You've Got Mail. And Do the Right Thing, another Spike Lee movie. Although, in fairness to Scott and Dorgas, I think they wanted to make sure all movies were family-friendly, and I think they had the view that Do the Right Thing had some harsh language in it, so that may why it didn't make it. So, in any event, I'll just give you my list of five, and it doesn't take a lot of imagination because of the titles. Number one, Manhattan. Might be a quintessential New York movie. Two, Saturday Night Fever.
Yeah.
Three, Brooklyn. That's an excellent movie just a few years ago.
Yeah.
Four, The French Connection. One Best Picture. Great movie about New York. And five, in my mind, the hands-down winner, West Side Story.
I think those are excellent choices.
Thank you. And
do you think they were trying to choose things that weren't something people had seen?
No.
That were less on the...
No, I do think they have a tendency to be somewhat esoteric. And they play critic a little bit, and they came in, they're always trying to make an interesting choice. I think that's probably not the right approach when you're looking for a, quote, quintessential New York movie. So, you know, something to think about. If you find yourself at an outdoor showing of Crooklyn, pursuant to this program, you might have had the opportunity instead to see West Side Story, but wasn't one of the nominees. So, that's all we have this week.
This week, a special birthday edition for Sadie Eleanor Abuja.
Yes, happy birthday, Sadie Eleanor.
And see you next week with Tamsin and Dan Read the Paper.